supporters for a new fire station in Meridian Township near the corner of Okemos Road and Central Park Drive got their wish yesterday. The State Journal's Dawn Parker writes today that Judge Joyce Dragonchuk denied a temporary restraining order that was filed by residents who live very near the proposed station. Again, Okemos Road, near Okemos Road and Central Park Drive. Those residents have claimed the new station will interfere with quality of life and reduce property values. The attorney for residents of the Autumn Park condominium says his side will review the options. Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore on 90.5 WKAR. We're glad you're with us today. Earlier this year, in his State of the State address, Governor Rick Snyder emphasized his administration's desire to increase immigration to Michigan.
We need to encourage immigration in our state. That's how we made our country great. We need to focus on legal immigration and make sure people know Michigan is the most welcoming place. And I'm intent on moving forward with that.
Recently, state officials got news that could move the state closer to that goal. Last month, federal customs officials approved the state's application to launch an initiative that could attract more foreign investment and workers to the state. Michigan is only the second state in the nation to get approval for an EB-5 regional center. The center will try to connect foreign investors and workers with potential development projects around the state. Supporters say that could provide an economic spark as well as more immigration opportunities. Our next guest is playing a leadership role in the EB-5 initiative. Scott Woolsey is already executive director of MISHDA, the Michigan State Housing Development Authority, and is president and CEO of the Michigan Community Development Corporation. Scott Woolsey, welcome to Current State.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
When this EB-5 center is up and running, what exactly will Michigan have that it doesn't have now?
Sure. It'll have a couple of things. One, it'll have additional capital. The requirement for the EB-5 visa program is that foreign nationals invest either $500,000 in a targeted economic area or $1 million in a non-targeted economic area. That investment must create 10 jobs for Michiganders. So Michigan, it gets a win-win, and we like to think of it as a win-win-win situation. Not only are we attracting foreign investment to the state, we're creating jobs for Michiganders, and we hope to encourage those foreign investors to actually locate here.
But will the EB-5 center, are we talking about an office with a staff working on making these connections that I alluded to earlier?
That's correct, okay. We'll have an office both in Detroit and one in Lansing.
Two offices.
Yeah.
And how many people will be working on this?
Well, MISHDA is going to staff the regional center as it gets started. And we've created the Michigan Community Development Corporation to function in that capacity. We've got about 250 people that work with us. We manage around a $4 billion balance sheet. We're well served to manage the center and to make those investment decisions.
When will it be totally up to speed?
We hope to make our first investment before the end of the year.
Okay. And when you talk about targeted economic areas and non-targeted economic areas, tell us what you mean.
Yeah,
by
a targeted economic area is defined under the EB-5 Regional Center regulations as being 150% of the unemployment rate of the nation. So if we have areas that are more than 150% of the unemployment rate of the nation, then those are targeted economic areas.
I know there are data that suggest an economic spark that immigrants, especially immigrants with particular skills, can provide. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, immigrants are net job creators. They're about six times more likely to create jobs than we as U.S. citizens are. So it has a dramatic positive effect. When you couple that with the fact that we're attracting additional capital, we could be attracting as much as $100, $200 million worth of additional capital to the state. Each one of those million-dollar investments has to create 10 U.S. jobs. So it's a huge job-creating machine.
We are talking with Scott Woolsey here on Current State. Scott is the executive director of MISHDA, the Michigan State Housing Development Authority, and is one of the leaders of the new EB-5 Center initiative that Michigan just got permission to launch from federal authorities, and this will supposedly pave the way and connect Michigan with more foreign capital and provide immigration opportunities. This sounds like it's really closely related to the proposal from Governor Snyder to attract skilled immigrants, specifically to Detroit, that was announced not that long ago. So this is part and parcel of the same thing.
It is part, okay. Yeah. We're part of a much bigger puzzle that the governor has.
Okay. You expect Michigan's universities and colleges to be a link in this chain somehow as well. Can you explain that?
Absolutely. We have roughly 26,000 foreign graduate students in the state right now. We've got two of the leading universities. I happen to be from another university that's down the street. But those are our exports that we value very highly. We encourage those students to stay in the states. They are we've educated them. We've given them the best education in the United States, in our belief, and we want them to stay here in Michigan. So not only are they a link to other foreign investors, but we also want to encourage them to stay here in the states.
Is there a particular challenge in making this work that concerns you? What are the hurdles to really making this work?
You know, the biggest hurdle, Mark, was getting the regional center approved. But we had congressional support, we had support from the governor, we had support from the mayor, and I'm not sure it was a record, but our regional center got approved much more quickly than we anticipated. Sometimes it takes as much as 9 to 12 months. Ours took a little less than 4 months.
I know Mayor Mike Duggan of Detroit was quite an advocate.
Mayor Mike Duggan was a huge advocate. He not only supported us in our efforts, but he also supported us at the White House.
How big is your budget going to be?
Our budget right now is about $2 million to operate the regional center. Eventually, that budget will get quite a bit bigger as we roll the program out and as we increase the investments.
You're off to Asia soon to promote this. What countries will you be visiting?
The next trip that we're making is to China and to Vietnam. China is obviously the largest user of the EB-5 visa program. But we've made trips to the Middle East. As you know, we have one of the largest Arab populations outside the Middle East here in Southeast Michigan. And there's a huge connection between Michigan and the Middle East. We've made a couple of trips to the Middle East, and there's a significant amount of interest for this program from the Middle East.
How will you be determining which countries to promote this?
Well, as I said, China is the largest user of the EB-5 visa program. But every group out there has an interest. I mean, we still are the greatest country in the world, at least it's our opinion. And Michigan offers so much in terms of lifestyle and outdoor amenities. So we've been promoting it to not only to China and to Asia, but also to the Middle East. And we also have some trips planned down to South America.
How exactly do you promote this abroad? You're in Shanghai or Beijing or Ho Chi Minh City or wherever it happens to be. Do you connect with lenders? How do you connect with foreign investors in those countries?
Yeah, it seems like a black box, doesn't it? What we do is we announce to the local government that we're coming in and we're promoting the program. In general, they will kind of shepherd us through and set up meetings for us. In addition, we have reached out to all the banks. All the banks and all the law firms have tons of clients in those countries, high net worth individuals. And so they've kind of opened the door because we are kind of the platinum EB-5 visa program. There are roughly 500 regional centers around the country. Many of those have failed in one piece of the puzzle, whether it be providing a return of capital, providing a return on capital, or ultimately producing a green card through compliance.
These are 500 federal centers?
These are 500 federal licensed centers, and there's not quite 500. I think there's 483. But many of them have made investments that weren't prudent, or they have not produced green cards at the end, and you're seeing some of that. There's only one other state in the country that has a state-run EB-5 regional center, and that's the state of Vermont.
Vermont, yeah.
And we have modeled our program after the state of Vermont's program.
Has Vermont launched their EB-5 program long enough ago that you can track their performance?
They have. They have invested almost $500 million in EB-5 visa money since 2008.
How long has this EB-5 option been around?
The Congress passed this in 1990, and the idea behind it, Mark, was to stimulate the U.S. economy through foreign investment and job creation. And it's been utilized piecemeal to date, but never as successfully as the state of Vermont had. And we saw that what the state of Vermont did, we said, hey, this is an opportunity for Michigan. Let's take the ball and run with it.
If I'm not mistaken, there's been an EB 1, 2, 3, and 4, and this is like the latest iteration, if you will,
that's correct.
Of the EB
that's correct.
Program. Is there an advantage to being among the first states to offer this?
We think so. We take a real client-centric approach. We actually treat our foreign investors as our customers. And there's really three legs of the stool that you've got to have to make a successful EB-5 program. You have to provide a return of the capital. You have to provide a return on their capital. And ultimately, you have to produce a green card. And we feel we are very well suited to do all three. We've got experience in making investments throughout the state. We know the economics of making those investments. And we have a compliance department that manages billions of dollars of U.S. funds. So we're well versed in making those decisions.
Do native Chinese people already in Michigan, do they play a role in helping establish links with this foreign capital?
They certainly have, yeah, absolutely. Not only are they net job creators here, but they're entrepreneurs, and they have lots of contacts back in China. So that's been one of the mechanisms that we've used to make contacts with potential investors.
I want to ask you one other question specifically related to Detroit, less about the EB-5 situation. As the executive director of MISHTA, you're involved in the elimination of blighted property in Detroit, at least, if not other Michigan communities. Can you tell us where that process is at right now?
Yeah, the Blight Task Force is actually meeting later this morning. I'm on my way to Detroit after this interview, and they're coming out with their recommendations to the federal government and to Mike Duggan as to what should proceed forward. We've got a tremendous amount of effort behind this. Everyone has been at the table, from the state to the city to the foundations. And I think you're going to see a significant change in the direction of blight removal here in the next couple of weeks.
We'll keep an eye on it. We want to thank Scott Woolsey, Executive Director of the Michigan State Housing Development Authority, President and CEO of the Michigan Community Development Corporation, and a leader in the new state EB-5 initiative for which Michigan was just approved by the federal government. Scott, good luck. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. Most people don't travel to Venice and think sea monsters, but most people aren't novelist Christopher Moore. Current state's Emmanuel Berry had the chance to speak with the New York Times bestselling author, who has an appearance at Schuler Books Eastwood Town Center this weekend. Emmanuel, what did you learn about this latest novel from Christopher Moore, The Serpent of Venice?
Well, it's set against the backdrop of Venice, hence the title. And it blends together Shakespeare's The Merchant of Venice and Othello, and then also throws in a little bit of Poe. You just then throw in a couple of sea monsters, humor, body prose, and that's The Serpent of Venice, his latest novel. It's actually a sequel to his novel Fool, which retells King Lear from the perspective of the witty and lewd court jester who's named Pocket. But Moore's work goes beyond retelling literary classics. His other books include Lamb, the story of Jesus from the perspective of his childhood friend Biff, a trilogy of vampire books, and A Dirty Job, which follows a newly employed merchant of death. Although many of his books feature these dark and tragic topics and events, they're written with humor. It's sort of Moore's comedic take on the world.
I've actually tried to write more serious stories before, and I don't get very far in before I start to joke about stuff. So it's not, I mean, so for a long time, that's how I approach things, is my take on the world tends to be comedic. And dealing with darker subjects that tend to not always be approached with humor is just sort of, again, my way of dealing with it. I fancy myself a horror story writer when I first started, and it was only when I was reading my stories aloud in workshops and people started laughing at how I turned a phrase that I thought, well, maybe I'm better at doing funny stories, but I think I still have a little bit of the horror story writer in me.
Your latest novel, The Serpent of Venice, is a sequel to your book, Fool, which retold Shakespeare's King Lear through the lens of the fool in that book. And in your book, he's named Pocket. As if tackling Lear weren't enough, in The Serpent of Venice, you've combined two of Shakespeare's works, The Merchant of Venice and Othello, and you've also thrown in a sea monster and a little bit of Poe. Why did you decide to combine all of these works to tell this story?
I started with Venice as a setting, and I had been in Venice. I had gone to the Mantua Literary Festival by invitation, and then afterwards, you know, since it wasn't far, I stopped over in Venice to see what it looked like. And I thought this would just be a great place to have to set a monster story, these really narrow alleys and all these, you know, obviously canals that the water's sort of murky, and these there's these hatches for the freshwater wells that sort of sit up, and you think, well, something creepy could come out of there. So it started with the setting, and then as I started to look at stories that had been set in Venice and things that I could do historically, because I didn't want to set it in modern Venice, it just sort of led me to you know, the Shakespeare plays that had been set there. And then once I started deciding I was going to take my Fool from Lear, then the other story that occurred to me was The Cask of Amontillado by Edgar Allan Poe, which sort of is about a fool, or a guy dressed as a fool who's being walled up in a cellar in Venice. So that was really it. It all sort of sprung from wanting to tell a story that's set in Venice and then sort of spread out to the other things that I was familiar with and felt that I could handle putting into a story.
Fools in Shakespeare are often extremely minor characters. In Lear, in the original work, the fool disappears after the beginning, seeing him in the beginning. What about this character made you want to broaden his voice and explore him further?
I think it was more what the role of the fool was, well, in King Lear certainly, but in general at the time, was the fool was the one person who could speak truth to power. And when I wrote the first book, Fool, I was sort of reacting to how frustrated I was that I only felt like I was actually getting truth about political matters in the U.S. from comedians. And that sort of spurred the idea of writing a book about a fool. And then my editors suggested, when I proposed it, that I use King Lear's Fool. And it went forth from there. But really, it's the role of the fool that started it all, and then the specific character Pocket developed as I tried to, you know, give him more dimension than, as you say, the character in King Lear that just disappears after the first act.
You did a lot of research, I imagine, a lot of brushing up on your Shakespeare for Fool. What additional research did you have to do to complete The Serpent of Venice?
Well, in the case of both books, I don't think that I have whatever mental powers it requires to write an iambic pentameter, and I tend to write by ear, and I also had to write for both books a dialect that sounded Shakespeare-y but wasn't, you know, that was really easily understandable by the modern English speaker in America. So I listened to a lot of performances of the Shakespeare plays in both cases when I was writing both books, just so I could sort of write this Shakespeare-y sounding language by ear without having to do it by math, which I just don't think I have the ability. I think the invocation at the beginning of the book, there's a little bit of a verse that is written in iambic pentameter. It took me like 2 days to write. It's like a half a page
long. So we never would have gotten the book if
you... Yeah, I'd still be working on it. So so that's really... there was a fair bit of historical stuff to do about Venice in the 13th century, because my story is set in the 13th century, while Othello and Merchant of Venice are set in the 16th century, 15th or 16th, probably 16th century. And so there was a change to find out, you know, what's going on politically and socially in Venice at the time. And it actually really added a lot to the book and the story to move it that, you know, 300 years from the 16th century.
One of the things that I find myself doing when I'm reading your work is laughing out loud, often at inappropriate times and inappropriate settings. Point is, books don't often, you know, cause me to laugh uncontrollably. How do you go about trying to translate that comedic timing onto the page? Because I think that's what gets me is when I'm reading, I can hear it, I can see it.
I think that you hit on it, you know, sort of by accident. It's you hear it, and I was just actually yesterday talking to a friend of mine who's a very accomplished, brilliant stand-up comedian named Jake Johansson, and we were talking about that very thing. Is that I told him, I said, I steal comic timing from you all the time. But because I write prose, no one will ever know it. You know, no one can hear it. But that's what it's the same as writing the Shakespearean dialect, but it's not Shakespearean. You take an audible comic timing and you just learn how to punctuate it. You learn how to sort of soften it going into the line and then delivering the line and sort of, I don't want to be too analytical in an interview, but basically you do it by ear. I listen to how it would sound and then figure out how do I write that down. And often you put a line of description in to give you that pause that's needed to deliver the laugh, or you put a he said or she said in when you need a beat. So a lot of it, and most of it, I would have to say the comic timing comes from hearing it in my head before I write it down and just figuring out how to put that on the page so that you'll hear it in your head when you're reading it.
I'm speaking with Christopher Moore, author of many books, including Lamb, A Dirty Job, and Fool. His latest book is called The Serpent of Venice. I'm curious, you've tackled the story of Christ in Lamb, which is the retelling of Jesus's lost years by his best friend, Biff, and you've rewrote Shakespeare's Lear, and now in your latest book, The Merchant of Venice and Othello. Have you received a lot of grief from, I guess, purists for retelling these stories?
No, not at all. In fact, completely the opposite. Lamb is being taught in at least a dozen seminaries that I know of, and in some really good universities and colleges that I would never be allowed into. So they've sort of transcended, my base roots. And when I do hear from, particularly people in theater, I haven't heard too much from Shakespearean scholars, but I hear a lot of from teachers who teach Shakespeare to undergrad level or to high schoolers, and they love Fool. Obviously, they haven't been exposed to Serpent of Venice yet because it's just coming out. And actors and directors, theater directors, love it because King Lear can be a really, I don't want to say tedious, but it's a weighty play.
It is.
It's so hard to, and if you imagine you're a director or an actor and you have to do 300 performances of it, you know, with that whining by King Lear, it'll just drive you nuts. And so to sort of take the wind out of King Lear's sails by having this smartass, for lack of a better word, just sort of skip through the whole thing and take control of it was, so people that work with the text a lot really like it, and they recognize the sort of references to all the other Shakespearean texts, of which there are quite a few, but if you don't get them, you're not missing anything. If you're not conversant in Shakespeare, the story still works, and that's always what I set out to do, is that you shouldn't have to have a familiarity with Othello or The Merchant of Venice or King Lear to enjoy the story. I want it to be able to stand on its own.
What's your least favorite part of the writing process?
Oh, the writing. Unfortunately, the most important part is also my least favorite part, and that's that you have to have a discipline to it when you write novels. You can't write novels sort of on a bolt of inspiration. They're just too big and too much of a project. So you really have to treat, the work with this sort of reverential drudgery. And the best part is inspiration, is when you just get to, sit there and think of all this goofy stuff and it's just sort of still amorphous, and it's sort of swirling in your head with ideas and characters and funny lines and all that stuff. That's the best part. It's just making stuff up is the best part, and probably having to write it down is the worst part, which is not that I don't enjoy. I enjoy crafting the writing. It's the getting to the place where you're actually putting it down is just always been really difficult for me. And I've this is my 14th book, and I still have a hard time, getting my butt in the chair and doing the actual work. It's everything else seems so much more compelling and interesting when you have to face it blank, that blank screen or blank page.
All of your books have been optioned for films, I believe. If you could see one and made into a movie, which one would it be and why?
I'd like to see A Dirty Job, which is my book about a guy getting the job of being deaf, and he runs it out of a secondhand store in Chinatown, because there's some great characters and there's some great creatures. I have this little girl is protected by these giant 400-pound hellhounds that just show up in her room in the middle of the night, and this little 5-year-old girl. And I would just love to see the hellhounds, to see what somebody who really, you know, knew what to do with CG and so forth, because the character in it, he just doesn't know quite how to deal with them, so he starts feeding them frozen steaks and toast with dishwasher gel on it, and finally he's like throwing them transmission parts, and they just chomp it down and don't even think about it. I think that it would be that I would just like to see it. I mean, it's sort of less about what story I want to see on screen, but just stuff that I don't have the ability to actually make those things physically, and film people do, you know.
Christopher Moore's books include Lamb, the Bloodsucking Fiend series, A Dirty Job, and Fool. His latest novel is called The Serpent of Venice. As part of his book tour, Christopher will be at Schuller's Books at 2 p.m. on Saturday, May 3rd. Chris, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
For Current State, I'm Emmanuel Berry.
And a reminder, you can connect with Current State via email with your feedback for our show and any story ideas you might have. currentstate@wkar.org. It's always great to hear from you. You can follow us on Twitter @KARCurrentState. Restoring sight to the blind and visually impaired has long been thought of as more in the realm of science fiction than actual science. But Roger Ponce of Reed City, Michigan, would beg to differ. Diagnosed with a degenerative eye disease as a teenager, Roger was almost completely blind until last January, when he became just the fourth person in the United States to have a device called the Argus II implanted. He joins us now by phone from his home in northern Michigan. Welcome, Roger.
Good morning. How are we doing?
We're doing just great, thank you. And also joining us from California, Brian Meck, a vice president for Second Sight, the company that invented the Argus II device that has helped Roger to see. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being here.
It's our pleasure. Roger, I want to start with you. It's been since January that you've had the device. How have you been doing with it?
I've been doing real well. It's a great benefit. You know, it's just totally awesome to be seeing what I am seeing from this device.
What have you been able to do now? What, if anything, can you do now that you weren't able to do before?
Well, before I had this implanted, I used to have to put my hands in front of me, and I'd bang into walls in the house, and it was pretty frustrating. Now I don't do that no more. I haven't banged into the walls. I can get around my house real well. It's based on black and white. There's no color to it. Black on black things on white things on black, like my coffee cup on my table I can find, my dinner plate. My wife had a white shirt top on versus dark bottoms. I could identify that.
What was it like when you first tried it?
Oh, it was, you know, it's just, I don't really know the words for it other than just totally awesome. You know, they turned it on and they said they were going to check for the chip in my brain, make sure that was all right, and they shut it back off, and they turned it back on again, and I thought I'd seen a light, and I didn't know if I was hoping or dreaming, and they shut it off again, and they turned it back on, and I just blurted it out. I said, there's a light flashing on there, and nobody said nothing, and I turned to the doctors and that, and I said, there was a light flashing on there, wasn't there? And they're like, yep, there sure was. That was pretty awesome.
I can imagine. What did you do first?
What did I do first?
Yeah. What did you do that you weren't able to do up until that point?
Well, it's a process. You know, it's not going to happen overnight. So it's a slow process. So first things I seen were lights. So we came home that night, and my wife knew I could see lights, so she took a flashlight and shut the lights off in the house, and we played hide-and-go-seek, and I could find her.
Well, that's fantastic. How does it work? Do you understand well how it works?
Yeah, it really, you wear a computer, the chip is in my eye, you wear a computer, it's about the size of a cell phone, and then there's a computer on the side of the glasses. It relays everything from one computer to the other computer, back to the camera that is mounted on the bridge part of the glasses. It's about the size of a eraser on the end of a pencil, and I have to scan with my head back and forth, up and down. And right now I see flashes, and you have to, you know, determine what is there, what's not there, and so forth.
Let's bring in Brian Mack, Vice President of Second Sight. This is the company that makes the Argus 2 device that Roger has. Brian, how did Roger do in his description as to how this works?
Well, just like everything else, he did great, you know.
Thank you.
Pretty sharp guy. Hey, Roger.
Can you add anything to his description?
Yeah, I think you know, if your listeners are familiar with a cochlear implant, which is a device that's been around about 20 years or more, and restores hearing to people that are deaf, this works on exactly the same principle. We use electrical stimulation of the retina to reproduce an image that's captured by a video camera that's worn on the glasses by the user. So the video camera captures what's going on in front of them, and it's wirelessly transmitted to the implant, and then there's an array of electrodes that are fastened to Roger's retina, and we just stimulate the electrodes in that array, just like pixels on a scoreboard. And then the remaining nerve cells in his retina transmit that information to the visual cortex, and that's how he can see.
How long did it take to develop and test this?
Well, it was another overnight success, Mark. It was 20 years.
Okay, another 20-year overnight success.
Yes.
And what were some of the biggest challenges getting this done over those 20 years? Are you familiar with the history of the development?
Oh, absolutely. I've been with the company since it started. They varied along the way. First of all, you know, in the early days, all of the challenges were technical ones, you know, developing electrode arrays that would last in the eye, developing electronics that would last in the eye. This is the highest density, highest channel count neurostimulator ever developed. So those were technical challenges, and then
getting the body to accept this long term, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, accepting the device, so not rejecting the device. That's one thing, and then also building a device that could last inside the body for a long period of time. That was hard as well. And then, you know, then the challenges shifted. You know, once we had a device that worked, then the challenges shifted to, you know, we had to show clinically that it would work and help patients like or people like Roger. And then we had to convince the FDA, of course, that all of that data was sound. So we had to get FDA approval. And now I think, our challenges are on the reimbursement front, making sure that insurance companies will cover this for their beneficiaries.
I imagine the device, the Argus 2, isn't good for everyone who's with a visual impairment. Who does qualify as a good candidate for the implant?
Great question. The patient has to have a disease that's called retinitis pigmentosa. It's a degenerative inherited retinal disease that results in slow loss of vision over a period of time. Typically, patients are diagnosed in their teens, and the disease progresses, and they lose their vision completely by the time they're in their 40s or 50s. So as of today, the device can only help people with retinitis pigmentosa. We are working on a couple of things. We're going to start a clinical trial in age-related macular degeneration to see if it can help those folks. And then looking forward to the future, we're also developing a version of this device that can be used, instead of stimulating the retina, it would actually stimulate in the visual cortex of the brain. And if that works, then we can help basically people that are blind from any cause.
Our guests on Current State today, Brian Mack, Vice President for Business Development for Second Sight, the California company that developed the Argus 2 device that Roger Ponce of Reed City, Michigan, wears. He is just the fourth person in the United States to receive what's essentially a bionic eye. Roger, Can you take this on and off?
Yeah, the glasses plug into the computer, so you can just unplug the glasses from the computer and take them off. Yeah, but you know, like anything else, the more you use it, the more you wear it, you know, the better you're going to become, I think.
Have you acclimated to it? Does it feel really differently to have this?
No, they're very comfortable. Okay. They're made out of a pair of Oakley sunglasses.
How did you find out about the device?
I heard about this probably anywhere from 5 to 7 years ago on our local news, and I just kept following it, and finally got FDA approved.
Brian Meck, what are the risks involved with this? Are there significant risks that you have to assess?
I think, there's patient-specific risks, you know, that any patient that has to undergo surgery has to be aware of. Their doctor can advise them on that. There are some, you know, with any retina surgery, which this is one, this is performed by a retinal surgeon, there's always inherent risks with the surgery. So, for anyone who's potentially interested in getting the device, their doctor can explain this to them. So, yes, there are risks. There's definitely risks. But I think, you know, the clinical trial showed that while there were adverse events, they were all treatable, and no one had an untreatable adverse event. No one lost the function of their device due to any sort of safety concern.
The Argus 2 was approved in the EU, the European Union, in 2011, I believe. How many people have Argus 2 devices around the world?
I think we're right around 80 right now, somewhere around the 80 number.
And Roger is one of only four currently in the U.S. since FDA approval?
Yeah, since FDA approval. Now, there's 14 other Americans that have the device because they participated in the clinical trial. But since FDA approval, I think Roger is one of four patients at the University of Michigan that was implanted. I think he was number two.
That's correct.
The University of Michigan Kellogg Eye Center is where the procedures have been done. Brian, what drew you to partner with the center?
Well, you know, University of Michigan and Kellogg Eye Center are big names in ophthalmology. I mean, Michigan's a big name in pretty much any field, but, you know, Kellogg Eye is a big name in ophthalmology, sort of a prestigious center, and that's really what we're looking for. We're not, we have a Centers of Excellence business model here. We're not rolling this out at every hospital across the country. We're picking and choosing sort of the preeminent ophthalmology facilities around the country.
I have to ask you, as a veteran of this company, where is this technology headed? Do you have a good take on what the potential is here, the unrealized potential?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think there's really two arms in towards our development, and maybe even three. You know, in the short term, Roger was talking about having a computer. And that computer really does image processing. So we can improve the outcomes in our patients simply by changing the software and firmware on that computer as we learn more about how to process images. So in the short term, without even touching the implant for these patients, we can potentially improve their outcomes by improving our software. Longer term, we're working on a next generation device that has more electrodes. And you can think of the electrodes in the array as pixels on a screen. So the more pixels that you have, you know, just like in camera technology, the higher resolution image you can get.
Right.
Yeah. So that's sort of the medium-term objective, is to develop a device with actually four times as many electrodes as what Roger has. And our longer-term vision is the one I was sharing with you earlier about the cortical implant. And the big thing there is the fact that we can help people with basically that are blind from any cause, instead of just folks with retinal degenerative diseases.
Roger, this will be your first summer with this device. Anything you're looking forward to doing this summer that maybe you couldn't do in past summers?
Not really. You know, I'm very active. I fish. You know, I go to the gym. We got a bicycle where you sit side by side. It's like a mini golf cart. So, no, we've kind of, you know, prepared ourselves for when I went blind. So.
Well, it's still an extraordinary development. We're really delighted for you, Roger. Roger Ponce is a Reed City, Michigan resident who was just the fourth person in the U.S. to receive what's essentially a bionic eye. And also thanks to Brian Meck, Vice President for Business Development for Second Sight, the California-based company that developed the Argus 2 device. Thanks to both of you for joining me today.
Thanks, Mark, for having us.
Thank you.
It's WKAR's Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. The Library of America is reissuing legendary author Kurt Vonnegut's entire collection of novels in volumes, the latest of which comes out this month. Current State's book contributor Scott Southard is not objecting.
Listen, one of my writing heroes is Kurt Vonnegut, and for 4 years I had his home phone number sitting on my desk. That blessed number was a present from a friend of mine, and every day it taunted me, teased me. When Vonnegut died in 2007, I threw the number away. I never had the guts to call it. So it goes. The Library of America has been republishing Vonnegut's Complete Fiction Library in hardcover. This May, Volume 3, novels 1976 through 1985, will be released, and it includes what I would consider four lost classics by this master American novelist. If you only know Vonnegut from Slaughterhouse-Five, Cat's Cradle, and Breakfast of Champions, consider your summer reading list planned. In his memoir, Palm Sunday, Vonnegut graded his novels, and he gave the first book in the collection, Slapstick, a D. Mr. Vonnegut, I think that is unfair. In fact, this is one of Vonnegut's most imaginative tales. Slapstick is the story of Dr. Wilbur Daffodil 11 Swain, the last president of the United States. The campaign slogan that got him elected was, "Lonesome No More." He has a twin sister, and when they are together, they form a super intelligence. While Slapstick is mad and outlandish, Jailbird, the next book, is almost subdued, and in our reality. This novel tells the story of Walter F. Starbuck, who was the only person to go to jail for the Watergate scandal. Deadeye Dick, the next novel, follows the life of Rudy Waltz. He is living with the guilt of a murder. As a child, Rudy shot a gun out of his window, accidentally killing a woman in another house. It is probably the most tragic of the works in this collection. The fourth and final book is a true gem. Galapagos is the story of the evolution of mankind, or the de-evolution of it, depending on your perspective. The story is told by a ghost who watches these descendants of man for over a million years, waiting for the chance to enter a blue tunnel and go to the afterlife. It's now been more than 7 years since Vonnegut has become unstuck in our time. Sadly, I have little left to discover around one of my favorite writers, but thanks to the Library of America, they make it easier for everyone else. Honestly, I'm a little jealous of those who haven't read these works yet. Oh, and finally, why didn't I call Vonnegut? I'm sure he would have been nice to me, but I would have been the awkward stalking fan. It would have been a short call. I have no delusions of us being up all night, talking on the phone, until the birds started chirping. Potiweet? For Current State, this is Scott Southard.
And Scott's the author of two novels, A Jane Austen Daydream and Maximilian Stanforth in the Case of the Dangerous Dare. His writing on a variety of topics can also be found online at sdsouthard.com. His blog is called The Musings and Artful Blunders of Scott D. Southard. It's Current State on WKAR. We'll pass along that members of the Community Review Team, this is the team looking into the Board of Water and Light's response to the December ice storm, has told WKAR that their final report will be issued on Monday. That is coming out Monday from the CRT. You know, kids can go crazy about dinosaur fossils at the museum. Many of us grow out of that phase. Those dinosaurs might become reminders that we are turning into fossils, at least to our kids. But fossils are much more than just old bones. They can tell stories about where we came from and about our planet's history. Dr. Mike Gottfried is an associate professor in geological sciences at Michigan State University and curator of paleontology at the MSU Museum. Mike's here to share with us the stories that fossils can tell about evolution and climate change. Welcome, Mike.
Thanks. Very nice to be here. Thanks, Mark.
Before we look at some of the artifacts that you brought in, I know you've traveled widely as a paleontologist. Has there been a geographical focus to your travels and to your work?
I've done a lot of work in the Southern Hemisphere, and we know from geological evidence that the Southern Hemisphere continents were once joined together into a big supercontinent called Gondwana, and a lot of my research has focused on trying to uncover the story of how the split-up, the breakup of that Gondwanan supercontinent has affected evolution.
So what countries are we talking about here?
Madagascar, South Africa, New Zealand, Antarctica, a little bit of South America, really pretty much all of them, is the degree that I could.
Okay. Well, forgive the pun, but this is a groundbreaking segment here on Current State, because this is the first skull that we've had in Studio S. Can you describe, you've brought a couple of artifacts here with you today. Can you describe for our listeners the skull that you brought in?
Sure. I brought in, because I think it's an interesting piece of evidence that shows evolutionary connections, I brought in the skull of a small animal that belongs to a group called the mammal-like reptiles, cunningly named because they're reptiles that are very mammalian in some of their features. And so what they show is the transition from reptiles to mammals, and it's in a sense an evolutionary snapshot, because this little skull has some features that if you found them isolated, you would think, oh, you're dealing with a little mammal. But on the other hand, if you look at other parts of its anatomy, it's more reptilian. So the lower jaw is that of a reptile, but the teeth are starting to become kind of specialized. They're little incisors and molar in the front, molars in the back for grinding up food. So if you just looked at the teeth, it would look more mammalian. And it dates to about 240 million years ago, and it's from southern Africa. And that's a great place to go to look at that story of the transition from reptiles to mammals.
So you don't necessarily need the entire skeleton to figure all
that out. Yeah, good things come in small packages sometimes if you work on fossils. You don't necessarily need complete skeletons are great, but you don't always get them. And this is actually a cast of a skull from one of the museums in South Africa.
This is a skull It could definitely pass for something reptilian, I think, that is probably 3 inches long and probably an inch thick from top to bottom and maybe an inch and a half wide.
If you look at the teeth, it has little nipping chisel-like incisors in the front, and then it has a longer sort of stabbing-looking tooth in the middle and then grinding molar-like teeth in the back. And that's, again, something you would not find in a more typical reptile, which has more uniform-looking teeth. And one of the cool things on it is if you look really closely in the snout, there are little openings, and those are openings that, where the whiskers would have been situated. So think of a reptile with whiskers. We think of that as a mammal thing, something that your cats or dogs have and so on. So that's one of the features that puts it more toward the mammalian direction.
So we're essentially witnessing evolution with a piece
like this.
Evolution
in action. And that's the fossil record, you know, that I think is critical because it gives us this sort of deep time evidence for evolutionary transitions. And that's one of the more compelling ones, I think. It is kind of comparable to Tiktaalik, this so-called fishopod, or the fossil that shows the transition from fishes to land animals that's been featured a lot lately in the media.
Dr. Mike Gottfried is our guest. He's an associate professor in geological sciences at MSU, and we're talking about, he's brought in a couple of paleontological artifacts here with us today. PBS finished up a short series last week called Your Inner Fish,
right,
about how human anatomy shows that we share this common ancestor with fish and with other animals as well. Can you give us a couple examples of how our anatomy shows that?
Well, we have gill openings when we're really, really tiny and when we're developing embryos, and those disappear. If you actually look at one of the more compelling ways
where
to
are
think
those?
Of this,
where are those?
Those would be on the side of our throat, basically.
Oh my gosh.
Exactly in the comparable position where you'd find them on a fish, and they disappear as we develop embryonically. And also the muscles that allow us to do things like smile are actually directly comparable to the muscles that operate the gills in fishes. We've just kind of co-opted them and adapted them for another purpose. So we actually carry with us some of the features that our fish ancestries, if you go back hundreds of millions of years, had. Often the purpose has been changed, the function of those structures has changed, but the essential features actually are very comparable.
Amazing. Creationists sometimes often argue, that there isn't enough fossil evidence to support the science of evolution. What do you think?
Well, shockingly enough, from my perspective, I would argue with them on that point, but that'll come as a huge surprise. I think there's very compelling evidence from the fossil record, and I think Darwin himself in his main work on this was published in 1859, was troubled at the time by the lack of what he thought of as transitional fossils in the record, fossils like Tiktaalik, which features in Your Inner Fish, like the little skull that I brought in. But in the years since then, I think there's been a lot of fossil evidence uncovered that shows these evolutionary transitions. So you have things that are in effect composites of the group that they're descending, that are in the group that they share an ancestral relationship with, but they're also showing features of the group that they're evolving into.
I got it, exactly.
So again, there's snapshots, basically evolutionary snapshots.
You brought in a much smaller piece, smaller than the skull here. Tell us about this.
I brought in a little shark tooth. And one of the other things, along with looking at evolutionary transitions and looking at the fossil evidence for evolution, another thing that's of great interest to paleontologists, and particularly with respect to current concerns over climate change, is seeing what the fossil record and what the deep time history of our planet tells us about how climate has changed over millions of years. So I brought in a little shark tooth that's from a type of shark called a sand tiger shark. And it was collected, and I was involved in this research up in the Canadian Arctic at about 75 degrees north latitude, not very far from the North Pole. And 50 million years ago, when this shark lived, that area was essentially subtropical. And this shark lived in the ancient Arctic Ocean, where no shark could survive today because it's much colder. So it's showing us in a really vivid way how the climate has changed over the course of those millions of years.
So
and you could still cut yourself on the tip of this thing. So
really?
Be careful, Mark.
Okay. I can see this is...
Yeah,
The oldest thing I have ever touched in my life.
I wouldn't want you to do yourself an injury on the.
It's not very big, but I'm sure it does look somewhat lethal.
And you could look at teeth of living sand tiger sharks, and they would look essentially identical to that.
If I could get in a time machine and go back to the Arctic at that time, then what do you think I'd see?
Oh, you'd see dense forests with palm trees and broadleaf trees. There'd be turtles, alligators. Big hippo-like mammals. The oceans would have had a large number of sharks and fishes that are usually found in much warmer climates. So basically, it's peaking at about 50 million years ago. The Earth was a much warmer place uniformly over the entire globe. But actually, subtropical conditions extended almost to the polar regions.
Now, does that suggest that because of climate change, that tropical animals might again live in the Arctic someday?
Indeed. We try to project out into the future using what we know from the past as a key to try to interpret and understand that. And current trends, if you look at climate models from all the leading scientific academies, project continuing temperature increases that will affect the polar regions. And I think there's already evidence that plant and animal groups that are expanding their range northward in the northern hemisphere and southward in the southern hemisphere, there's some animals and plants that are great opportunists. So some species that are not well adapted to broader environmental changes will die out, but others are opportunists and they'll take advantage of the changes.
Mm-hmm. What is it like to search for fossils?
Well, it's the for someone who does what I do, it's sort of the ultimate treasure hunt. So the excitement of finding things and being out in the field, we usually end up camping in pretty, sometimes rather isolated and extreme environments. So there's a lot of excitement just physically being in those kinds of places. And a lot of it is sometimes, in some cases, tedious because there's a lot of exploration, a lot of hiking, cover a lot of ground.
Is Africa still I've gotten the impression over the years Africa is a real center of paleontological activity. Is that the case?
Africa is at the center of a lot of interesting questions, and it was right in the middle of Gondwana, this ancient southern hemisphere supercontinent. So it's been kind of an evolutionary crossroads in that sense. The challenge in Africa is that a lot of it's still covered in dense vegetation, and there are also places that are isolated and difficult to travel to. The infrastructure there in many places doesn't always make it easy to do that kind of work, but I've spent about 10 years doing field work in Tanzania on a project and loved it. A wonderful place to work.
Our guest has been Dr. Mike Gottfried, Associate Professor in Geological Sciences at MSU. We've been talking about fossils, the paleontological, there I said it, record here on Current State. Thanks very much, Mike.
My pleasure. Thank you, Mark.
That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll go behind the music of Graduation, learn how a British march became the standard soundtrack for high school and college commencement ceremonies. That and more tomorrow on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us. This is 90.5 WKAR.